My name is Peggy Liu, and I am the chairperson of an organization called JUICE, or Joint U.S.-China Collaboration on Clean Energy. And I've basically been at the heart of the greening of China for the last 10 years and traveling around the world to different countries, helping affect basically people's minds and hearts to want to shift towards a greater, better way of life.
I think your timing's probably pretty good, huh?
Oh, well...
Did you have some in that allowed you to begin working at such a high level in terms of collaboration, I guess?
So, well, I mean, one is I'm 49 years old, so I've been around the block. I've been a McKinsey alum, a management consulting. I was at MIT. I did programming. I was in Silicon Valley starting one of the early e-commerce companies. So I've been around the block. But in 2007, I had a very unique opportunity to open up, which is I met the president of MIT, the institute, and she was just coming in. I've worked with three different presidents there, and she's very unique because she was the first female. And as an alum, when there were very few women there, I felt like I needed to help her in some way. And she said she wanted to reorganize the institute around clean tech and life sciences because that's where they could have the most impact on humanity. So I said, well, you know, a friend of mine in Silicon Valley, Iyer Ehrenpreis, does these clean tech investors conferences. So I'm just going to copy that. You know, I was a VC at the time, venture capitalist at the time. And so I said, I'm just going to invite some friends together and we'll call it a day, right? We'll call it the first world-class clean tech investors conference in China. And so I started to, you know, organize this. And a year later, I realized, wow, we just created the first public dialogues between U.S. and Chinese government officials on clean energy. And to me, that was a surprise because this was 2007, after all. But, you know, China hadn't started to go green yet. And in one decade, China has gone from the polluter of the world to now the polluter of the world that's trying to create the best sustainable solutions for the world.
For all the right reasons?
For all the right reasons. I mean, number one, your health of you and your loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
What better reason is that?
All right. Let's talk about the China dream then.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. How do you like to talk about it? I mean, I think I saw the words social movement to transform consumerism.
Yeah. Well, so remember, I'm an environmentalist and I'm from America originally, and I've been in China for 14 years, and I've seen environmentalists fail miserably at trying to get...
You speak Mandarin?
I speak Mandarin and English. Tried to learn French. That wasn't so successful, so don't test me on that. A little bit of Maori in New Zealand. So the China Dream is basically our attempt that we started in 2010 to... retell this story of environmentalism and sustainability and trying to take something really dry, which is climate change, ecological civilization, eco, green, clean tech. I mean, stuff that honestly, it doesn't touch your heart. It's not going to make you change your behavior on a day-to-day basis. So we decided that the best way to get into people's hearts is to talk in a language that affects your personal prosperity. So we did all sorts of ideation workshops with post-it notes to say, what would your China dream be? What would your nightmare look like? And then we took sort of the intersection between those words of prosperity and sustainability, like survivability, like livability, like thrivability, you know, all those words that are something that everybody cares about. But to get there, we have to go green, right? So essentially, the China Dream is a Trojan horse to environmentalism, right? And that's also why I'm doing food right now, because food is the single largest impact on the environment, yet it's also the largest issue that we have with personal health. And so, happily, if you care about your own personal health, you're going to care about the environment. So the China Dream in 2010 is something that we started as essentially a narrative, a new narrative. And luckily, in 2012, 2.5 years later, almost 3 years later, Tom Friedman wrote about our project called China Needs Its Own Dream in his column. And that got picked up by one of the largest magazines in China. They did a full cover story, The Power of the China Dream. And lo and behold, Xi Jinping stepped into office the next month. And he used the term China Dream in his first speech. And now it's basically this national slogan. So the China Dream is not just economic development. It's about environmental protection, in that we need a livable China as well. So they go hand in hand. We can't sacrifice people or the environment just because we want to grow. They're willing to actually slow down economic growth in order to make sure that people are happy.
Do you have to convince them that there are things they don't want?
So them is really not a great word for China, because one, China is more like a continent of many, many different countries. And each country or province is many, many times the size of states here. So them is a very complex, you know, picture. In China, luckily, we have a lot of thems who are all interested in stopping the pollution that is visible outside your window, that poisons you and creates cancer hospitals, that seeps into our rice as we eat it, right? That pours out of the yellow or red water in our taps, right? Hmm. So we, or let's say they, are all incented to go green. Now, we don't necessarily have the solutions to go green, to have a more livable society. And that's where the last 10 years, China has really been searching abroad, looking to Europe, looking to the U.S., looking to Australia, and saying, how do they do it? What can we take from lessons abroad to land in China but implement it at much greater scale? Can we build cities in a green way? Can we make electrical grids smart? Can we use energy-efficient lighting? Can we build buildings so that they don't use as much energy or electricity? Can we grow our food in different ways, in healthier ways? So they are searching for all these solutions. But the fantastic thing is that because they're implementing at China scale, right, 1.3 billion people in China, they can actually commercialize these technologies and bring down the costs much faster than anybody else in the world. And yet, they also want to bring these solutions to the rest of the world. So that's the miracle of what's happening in China, that it's not just making a greener, better, more livable China. It's really making a greener, more livable world for everybody. Your face is looking like maybe a little bit doubtful. I'll give you a story. My good friend, Helen Hai, who we know each other from the World Economic Forum, the Young Global Leaders Forum, and she's a fantastic Shanghainese who has this sort of fairy tale story of becoming an investment banker in Europe, then coming back home. And one day she was asked to be on a delegation with a shoe manufacturer, a CEO of a shoe manufacturer, to see the president of Ethiopia. This was several years ago. The president of Ethiopia invited them to help stimulate the economy by creating a shoe factory. So she was responsible for this. In 3 years, she's created over 4,000 jobs, not just at that shoe factory, but she's made a whole light manufacturing zone in Ethiopia with the president. And now 8 heads of state in Africa are looking to her, the Made in Africa initiative that she founded, to help create light manufacturing initiatives using old retired Chinese executives from factories and the China factory model to come to Africa. And why would China want to do this? Well, this is a little bit of a complex economic story. But China, remember, wants to raise its middle class, right? From the rural poor to a middle class. To do that, we need to sell more consumer goods, services, rather than just heavy industry or light manufacturing. So essentially, we're eliminating light manufacturing, something that gives us low profit. We want higher profit, right? Mm-hmm. So that's, for example, look at Silicon Valley.
So they'd like to move out of the manufacturing field.
But what's going to happen to those 85 million people who are working in factories? Mm-hmm. 85 million people working in factories are going to have to do something else. Somebody else is going to have to be the manufacturing floor for the world. And why not Africa? Why not train and give jobs to Africans, which would be great for the world, so less dependent on aid. Give them jobs so that they can be the energy efficient, green model factory of the world. And then China can move to a different level of economic development. So it's win-win.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that. I see that playing out to a certain extent. I mean, you know, you hear more diabolical motives tossed around, but yes. I see the.
There's always shades of gray.
Yeah.
Complex motivations, but generally speaking, I think the lessons to be learned in China now are so vast because China is innovating at a speed that nobody in the world has ever seen before. Mm-hmm. So it now has the number one drone company. Right, it has the largest e-commerce companies. It has probably the largest, I guess, equivalent to Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. It's called WeChat. 800 million people use it every day. Right, so this type of innovation then can come back out and benefit the rest of the world.
And you're saying that you don't need to win people over to the idea of sustainability. They already want to do it.
Not in China. Right. So in China, 2007, they had a national plan that says climate change is real. Man caused, and China needs to do its part in 2007. And if you look at the five-year plans by the president to say, where is China going to go? Where are we going to spend the money? What are our priorities? You'll see energy, 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 clean tech, clean tech, clean tech, right? Efficiency, efficiency, efficiency. Reforestation, reforestation, reforestation. Less pollution, less pollution, less pollution. Environmental law, environmental law, environmental law. So, but if you look at other countries, they may not even believe in climate change, much less do something about it. Whereas China is putting a lot of money into infrastructure because they know that infrastructure is the foundation, the bed for livability and happy citizens.
Wait, no. So you don't have to win it over converts to sustainability, or you do? You're saying in China?
Well, in China, the government is very, very willing, and it has invested trillions of dollars in going green. Now, changing individual behavior is a much harder issue, right? So you've got this conflicting forces. You've got McDonald's and milk from Starbucks coffee, or like a lot of sugary drinks are coming in. Processed foods are coming in. When they opened up in 1990, this came flooding in. They didn't have grocery stores until 1990, right? So now KFC is the number one franchise in China, right? So with that, Chinese children, for example, have gone from 5% overweight and obese to 20% overweight and obese, right? China is one of the most overweight countries in the world behind the U.S. Diabetes alone is going to bankrupt the healthcare system, right? Because we have a disproportionate amount of diabetic patients in China compared to, you know, the population. So we have to change the way that we eat. We have to change all the plastic pollution from what we order. We have to go back to our roots. I think that's a similar case for Hawaii, too, right?
Oh, precisely. Yeah. Wait now. When you say we, who's we? Are you Chinese or are you?
I'm very half-half. So when I say we, when I'm speaking it abroad to people about China, then I'm very we. My whole family is in China, you know, from Xiamen to Hunan, Taiwan. Now we all live in Shanghai, right? So I've been there for 14 going on 15 years. I teach the Chinese government how to build cities. I've worked with the Chinese government to bring in smart grid, to revolutionize the electrical grid. I'm very proud of the direction that China is going, but I'm very Chinese American. I'm the first person born in my whole family in America, in Michigan, Ann Arbor, Michigan, of all places, right? So, you know, as an American, when I'm in China, then I try to bring the best of American culture and creativity, innovation to the Chinese society. When I'm abroad, I try to explain what's actually going on behind the Great Firewall in China, right? So I'm essentially a bridge.
And more bridging here. I mean, you were saying that you are working at like dismantling the jargon of sustainability.
Yes.
And even the images. We need to do that here as well. So what are you dismantling to?
So when we were doing this China Dream project and we were working with Ogilvy and Edelman and all these great advertising agencies, Saatchi & Saatchi, and then experts in sustainability, the aha moment for me was that food is the best Trojan horse to deal with all society ills. If you can get people to eat healthier, you can actually help achieve all 17 global goals from underneath the sea life, to above the earth, climate change, to poverty, to gender equality, to many, many of these sustainable development goals, all of them actually can be addressed if we just were to eat in a way that's good for us as well. Good for us is good for the planet, is good for society. So it's a Trojan horse. So that's why I'm working on Food Heroes, which is an initiative that we started in 2013, January, at Davos. And we've worked with some of the top chefs, top nutritionists, top sustainability experts, restaurants, to cartoon producers, to playologists, to gamification experts. And what we realized is if we can teach kids when they're still young, between kindergarten through third grade, like basically below ninth grade, below nine years old, mm-hmm. then you have a chance to get them to eat in a certain way before they're addicted to sugar, which is classified as a medically, addictive drug. Sugar is an addictive drug, right? So if you can get them to not eat sugar before that age, the way that we're all used to, if you don't get them hooked on going to Costco and Sam's for, you know, processed food, packaged goods, if you get them to grow seeds, my kids, when they were young, I let them grow basil seeds, snap peas, cherry tomatoes, and we made pesto, we made bruschetta at home. You know, they did it by themselves. So they see what it looks like to grow something and to cook something and then to share something with love. So sharing food, they see, is sharing love, right? So making that connect between your mind, your heart, and your stomach is what's going to save the world. That's why we're doing Food Heroes.
I mean, you know, I like the age group you're working with. What's some of the imagery and what kind of thing works for them?
Well, so the hardest part of what we did was not trying to create a new dietary recommendation that included nutrition but also sustainability. So we're not just saying what's good for you, but we're saying don't eat shark's fin soup. Shark's fin is bad for the environment, right? Don't eat certain things that are high carbon dioxide. So, for example, beef is 15%. Of all greenhouse gas emissions in the world comes from cows, right? 30% of all greenhouse gas emissions is from the food that we eat and the way that we grow what we eat. So what we decided was, okay, let's work with the top nutritionists like Walt Willett, who used to be the dean of nutrition at the Harvard Public School of Health, the Lancet Group, the top medical journal in the world, the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, who are one of the few universities that look at the intersection between nutrition and sustainability. So that actually was not the hardest part. We spent a couple of years doing that, and now we have the secret code to decipher whether or not your menu items are super boost foods or just like runaway foods, right? Sidekicks or caution foods. The hardest part is actually taking this information of what's good for you and good for the planet and trying to teach a kid who's just learning the names of colors, right? How can they decipher this food? So if you ask somebody, like somebody who does research and scientific papers all the time, to talk to a kid, they actually have a really hard time doing that. So the most difficult part of Food Heroes was taking words like biodiversity, micronutrients, a balanced diet, to say, eat a rainbow every day. Let's eat a rainbow every day. Or probiotics and gut digestion, and saying, let's be a poo detective, right? Kids love to say poo, especially around first grade kindergarten. You know, at least my son.
How does that work?
Saying poo or being a poo detective? Well, you know, if you look at your poo, and this in Chinese hospitals, they actually do this. If you look at your urine and poo, it tells you a lot about the state of your health. Did you know that?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's not something that Americans grow up doing, but I know in Chinese hospitals, they'll ask you as part of your medical exam, you know, is your poo like normal? That's the question. So you can tell the color, you can tell the texture of it, whether or not you're having enough water, if you're having enough vegetables, enough iron. If it's bleeding, then obviously it's not good. The color of your urine tells you how much water you're drinking, right? So be a poo detective. Be a pee detective. It's lots of fun. Sharing food and sharing love is really how the world goes around. You know, in New Zealand, where I've been spending a lot of time with the Maori tribe, they have something that I'm sure they have here too. It's called a karakia motukai. Karakias are basically a blessing. Motukai is for food. And so I noticed when I would stay in my friends' homes who are native, every single time we ate, we would hold hands around the table, and somebody would either sing beautifully or chant beautifully this karakia. And it essentially is thanking, you know, the Mother Earth, the Sky Father, the different gods of creation, and thanking the people that grew the food, thanking the people that cooked the food, and just being feeling blessed that we're able to share this food together at this table. And I think if we were to do one thing, and one thing only in educating kids and families, is to say this blessing, imagine all the things that they would learn about sharing food and sharing love, about eating together and instead of separately in front of an iPad or a TV, about the supply chain of food, right? That it was grown somewhere, that it was shipped somewhere, that somebody had to cook it before it got to this table, right? Think about the appreciation that comes from saying the simple karakia blessing.
Mm-hmm. We kind of condense that into one little itadakimasu in the Japanese way there. But you don't really have to convince kids to eat the right food, right? I mean, it actually tastes good. You found a way to...
No, you have to convince. Do you know why? It's because the parents are shopping at Costco. They're shopping at Sam's. I was just at a friend's home where the entire kitchen island was filled with boxes of processed goods. Now, processed goods is the largest source of sugar and sodium and preservatives, and that's what's causing the obesity, which is causing the diabetes. And then once you have diabetes type 2, it's very hard to avoid very large medical costs. And at the worst case, you have to amputate your limbs, you go blind. And certainly if you have diabetes, you're not going to be able to take care of your children. You're not going to be able to take care of your parents.
You know, let's really talk about this though then, Peggy. That just happens to be what? Is that the food I like the most, or is that the food I can afford at a certain, you know, at a certain point in the society here?
I think marketing advertisers have convinced us that processed foods are a savior, right, from heaven. It's been a 50-year experiment that has failed, according to Roger Lustig, Dr. Roger Lustig. And, you know, they essentially were telling us, these big food companies, that we're going to fortify this, right, that there's vitamins in here. But what it's been doing is essentially a sneak attack on our bodies. And the sugar, again, is addictive. And you add a little bit of salt, it becomes super addictive. You add crunch to it. I mean, you're just not going to be able to get away from processed foods. So as a result...
or from wanting them.
Yeah. So as a result, over half or 58% of Hawaiian adults are overweight or obese today. I think it's 1 in 3 Hawaiians are living with pre-diabetes or diabetes is what I've read.
Yes.
1 in 3. And that's really expensive, right? That's, I guess, 9 Aloha stadiums worth of people packed. So it's the 7th leading cause of death in Hawaii and also nationwide. So that's not good. If you look at every single health factor in the world, everything is getting better, like infant mortality, for example. We're living longer. Everything but obesity and diabetes is going the right direction. And it's because of processed foods. It's sugary drinks. So the World Health Organization last year in 2016 recommended all countries to put on a 20% tax on all sugary drinks. Your Coca-Colas, your Pepsis, your Fantas, right? And so in Mexico, in India, they've started to use these sugary drink taxes. And this revenue can go to food education, but it's also reducing consumption.
Mm-hmm.
So obesity and diabetes, I think even in the U.S., are starting to not grow, at least, right? Mm-hmm. It's tripled in the last, let's say, since 1970, but at least it's not growing much more because people are starting to get wise that sugary drinks, that ultra-processed foods are essentially like nuclear war on our body.
How are we actually going to be able to afford a truly nutritious diet, though? How are we going to do this?
So my belief is that a plant-based diet, strictly plant-based diet, is the best for you, especially if you're at risk for cancer. If you have diabetes or at risk for diabetes, if you want to reduce your weight, a plant-rich diet is by far the best diet. As a realist, I think even if you were to have 85% of your overall diet be a rainbow, right, every day versus of plants, I would say, versus, let's say, if you wanted to eat a little bit of chicken or fish for the rest of the 15%, as a realist, that's, for me, that's fine and it's very healthy. But in terms of affording plants, it's actually quite easy. You can grow them yourself. Certainly in Hawaii, this is probably the paradise of growing plants. There's no reason why everybody shouldn't be growing sprouts and salad greens on their porch here in Hawaii. Like, I would grow snap peas in my Shanghai window, right? I would, like, stick essentially vine trellises on my window and grow them. And my kids would just go and, like, they would pick them and eat
them.
That's
like snack amounts, though. That's not really what you can eat for a meal day after day.
Well, you know, again, you're in Hawaii, so you do have a lot more soil than I have in my 26-floor apartment
it's
in Shanghai.
It's possible to grow your own vegetables here.
Absolutely.
Not many would or do, though.
But you can invest in co-ops here, right? There's community gardens. But the fact is that plants are a lot cheaper than animal protein. And chickpeas and lentils and all sorts of – you have taro here, like a gazillion varieties of taros that people are trying to revive. So there's a lot more – plant varieties that are very, very affordable than big food is letting on, right? So if you look at, for example, Daphne Chung, she's from New York, and she just moved to Shanghai. She's a celebrity vegan chef, and she got her start doing these supper clubs and then creating Lady Bird, some other restaurants that are completely vegan. I mean, that's a much cheaper meal than it is if you were to spend a lot of money on Wagyu beef steak, right? In China, they're selling steaks for, let's see, 2,000 RMB divided by six for dollars.
Okay.
Right? So,
whoa.
You know, hundreds of dollars for a steak. Now, that's obviously not cheap. In terms of processed foods, what I would say is think about the medical costs that it is incurring you now or in the future, the lost salary if you do end up getting diabetes type 2, or you're too overweight and it's strenuous to go work.
What I hear mostly is people don't have the time to cook.
Well,
that's what they say.
You know, I am not a chef, but I do love to cook. And there's a lot of ways to prepare your meals, freeze them for the week. You can also do this in bulk, like, or together as groups of families. So in Chinese culture, I'll use the Chinese example since that's what I know. When I was at MIT, for example, we used to do dumpling parties all the time, right? And then you could have a freezer full of dumplings. I know when my kids were growing up, we loved dumplings. So we just had different varieties of fillings. So some would be vegetarian, some of them would be pork and vegetables, basically rainbow colors of dumplings. And then we would freeze them by the bag. And every morning we would eat dumplings. So whether in soup or pan fried, just with a tiny, tiny bit of oil, not like the whole thing from deep fried, and then steamed. So there's a lot of ways that I think if you just somebody taught you or if you looked into it. My friend Melanie Kosaka here in Oahu teaches people all the time how to cook. And it's very easy.
Planning ahead and just settling down and saying, I can do this.
Right.
Just get a little organized here.
Yes, exactly. Uh-huh.
That's really what it takes. It takes getting serious on that. Boy, I got you all the way from the big idea down to how am I going to make a meal tonight. That's really, really good.
Actually, I would say that if you were just to learn how to do five dishes, that you could make a whole bunch of different varieties from those five foundational dishes that would give you enough variety for your family. Mm-hmm. So things like egg dishes, omelets, there's a gazillion things that you can put in an omelet and different ways that you can fry it. Or not fry it, but
right, exactly.
Cook it.
Omelets
right?
are great.
Dumplings, again, if you're Asian – then there are literally a gazillion different ways to cook
and chop
dumplings
it all up and
different
wrap
fillings,
it.
Right, with different flavors of sauces and things like that. But, you know, you can buy the wrappers. You don't have to make them yourself like we did in Shanghai, right? And then if you have a food processor, actually it's really easy. Pestos. Pestos are so delicious, and you can make them out of so many different types of greens and nuts with healthy fats, right?
My famous beet loaf has nuts in it and rice, and you just put it all together with some egg in a loaf pan.
There you go.
There you go.
Right? I'm sure you can get pre-made pizza dough here. Mm-hmm. Right, or phyllo dough or things like that. You can make varieties of pizza really easily, right? All vegetarian pizza, none of this like pepperoni and sausage type of stuff. No, be a beautiful broccoli or broccolini with roasted tomatoes and roasted chilies and
all the anchovies,
oven dried mushrooms. You know, there are just so many things. Like, again, if you don't want to be too ambitious, just five dishes that you can make tons and tons of variety of these dishes and just, like, satisfy all your tastes for your entire family every single day. Very easy.
This is what it's going to come down to. It's going to come down to us wanting to do that.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It was really fun, Peggy.